asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to Ecclesiastes 2, where we are working on verses 20 and 21. All right, as the author of Hebrews says, the Christian way of life is a marathon. It is not a sprint. It is a race that is to be run on a daily basis. This has to be run according to the rules. We have to put aside those things that detract us or distract us from running the race. That includes the function of the STA through rebound. We all sin in many ways, so therefore we all have to deal with that sin. And as he said, putting aside the STA and every other encumbrance, these are things that are not necessarily sinful but get in the way of the unbridled pursuit of doctrine. So that has to be done. The race is being laid out before you by the communicator. That is his job, to set forth the particulars so that as a believer in time, you can understand God's plan to the extent that you need to. Take that doctrine, apply it, make it your own, and then, of course, apply it in the heat of the angelic conflict. So it's time to make sure you're in fellowship. This is the first order of the day, is to make certain that the STA is isolated. You cannot understand doctrine while you're under your STA. You will filter it through the sin nature. You will distort it. You will warp it. You will come out with some very strange readouts about what the Christian life is about, or what God is about, in fact, if that is the case. So that is absolutely critical. And then, of course, whatever else you need to do to put aside distractions, focus your attention and concentrate and profit from the teaching. Let us pray. Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for the grace that brings us together with the recognition that your plan of grace continues to march on despite all opposition. We recognize that in these last days our country has become the hold of every demonic and unclean and hated spirit, and that ultimately these are affecting mankind for the worse at very many levels in the angelic conflict. We recognize from our study of Timothy that believers are not immune to this and that they can partake of the satanic viewpoint simply by listening and failing to focus on that which is truly important and keeping their eyes on the straight and narrow of Bible doctrine. We pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will bless our thinking and continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we are here dealing now with another complaint that Koheleth, the younger Solomon, levels against life. As we have seen, this chapter has been filled with complaints against life. After he had gone through his period of self-indulgence and done all these things that one would figure would make a person happy, he has found out that it indeed did not, and that when he had done all this, it just left him with a greater sense of emptiness and depression than he had before. Again, what was he looking for in the first place? Why did he have this sense of depression, emptiness? Because he was out of sync with God's plan. He had begun to take liberties in certain areas that the Mosaic Law had forbidden. And so he began to lay up, as we know, horses, treasures, wives, all the things that were prohibited by the Mosaic Law. And Solomon did it. Well, you begin to violate these principles, you're going to pay the piper at some point if you want to dance. And so after this, he looks for something to satisfy him again, and he does his extensive research and finds nothing, finds absolutely nothing in all the things of life that one would think would make a person happy if they had the things that Solomon had. So again, this is very much, I think, on point for the average American today, because simply put, these are the types of things that they all strive for, the fame, the money, wine, women, song, all these things, various forms of entertainment and all of that, and which is all fine in its place. But that's the point. This has gotten out of control in his life, and it's not in its place any longer. So as he says, look, I've done all this, been there, done that, seen it all, heard it all, and I realized, man, guess what? I'm going to die at the end of it all. I'm going to die, and somebody else is going to get it. And it doesn't matter, really, at some point, since death is the great equalizer, as he would say. It doesn't matter whether you're wise or stupid, just live your life. But, of course, that is not the divine viewpoint, as we have pointed out. That is not a legitimate conclusion, logical conclusion, that one should draw from the reality of death. And so he bemoans the fact now that it's a very good possibility when people die, they're going to leave their inheritance to fools and not to wise people. But even if they leave them to wise people, kind of his whole point in all of this is, so what, even if I leave it to a wise person, it's still not mine. It's gone. And if I leave it to a fool, that only makes me feel worse. So at the end of it all, well, it's just not mine any longer. It's going to go, and that's it. So as we've seen here, he exercises and expresses in very strong terms these emotions. I hated all the fruit of my labor. I hated everything I'd accumulated. Why? Well, because he's going to leave it to somebody else. And so therefore I completely despaired, now verse 20, of all the fruit of my labor. Another strong term for depression here, as Solomon literally wants to throw in the towel but can't bring himself to do it. This is the enigma of the positive believer in some ways. They may pull some real stunts, but if they're positive underneath it all, God will do what he needs to do in their life, and they're going to be expected to make some decisions as well in order to track through this. And as we're going to see, obviously, this book would not be here, Solomon gets through this. He comes out on the other side. Because ultimately, underneath all of this, there lurks his positive volition, that he really does want to do it right. Now, he's pulled these stunts. He's done these things wrong. He's done things that, you know, most of us would probably never think of doing. Just as David did, his father. Most of us would probably not think of adultery and murder in one day. It might take us a week to come up with both of those. But the reality is he did it, but underneath it all, David was positive. And so his enemies are detracting him. They are ridiculing him. They figure God's done with him because he's committed this sin. No, God's not done with you unless you go negative. Then you're in real kinds of trouble. The point is, you can pull some real stunts, as we see these people do in the Bible. Abraham did, Isaac did, Jacob did. We see David did, Solomon did. We saw Paul there in Acts when he was completely out of God's will and out of fellowship and insisted on going to Jerusalem when God's will was for him to go to Rome. So what happened? Well, he ended up on this nasty. Now, God will correct your course for you if you're not willing to correct it for yourself. And that's one of the things that we would point out, is that if God does have to intervene in your Christian life, it's going to be in a judgment way in order to straighten you out. It won't be pleasant. It will be something difficult to line you out if you won't line yourself out. So Solomon, again, but underneath all of this, and we don't see it yet, but in this younger, bitter man, there is positive volition still. He still wants to do this right somehow. At the end of the day, at the bottom of it all, he's going to make it. And so, but you don't see that, of course. If you read this on the surface, you would think, well, this is just a bitter, despicable person. And at this point in his life, he kind of is. But underneath that bitter, despicable person, there lurks positive volition. Just like Saul of Tarsus, who would have guessed? How many first century believers you think would have guessed Saul of Tarsus was going to be the greatest apostle that ever lived when they first saw him? He breathing out, the very air he breathed was filled with threatenings and slaughter. I mean, this was the environment in which he lived. He loved it too. He enjoyed in it. He delighted in it. He loved killing these believers and putting them in jail. That was fun for him because he thought he was doing God's will, see? So who would have picked him to be ultimately one of the most positive people on the planet? Well, on the surface, you wouldn't. If he didn't humble himself, which he didn't, God humbled him. God got him. We see Nebuchadnezzar. He was an unbeliever but was positive. He wouldn't humble himself. Guess who humbled him? God did. We see Paul even in his Christian life. There he, you know, hey, I've got this problem with the pride grid, so God gives me the thorn in the flesh. So you can either deal with your pride or God can deal with your pride. But, trust me, you'd rather do it yourself. And so here you see Solomon, again, under all of this, there is lurking in the background. And I think this is another reason he is so frustrated, is because he is so conflicted. Because the positive believer is conflicted about all these things when they happen to him and they come down in his life. The positive believer really doesn't like the sin nature, really doesn't like sinning. Paul bemoans this there in Romans 7 and sets it forth in very graphic terms. I hate what I'm doing, and yet I'm still doing it. And so there's this conflict, this inner conflict that's going on at all times. And with Solomon, he's catered to the STA to the point, but he can't just throw in the towel in all of this, which is kind of neat, really, because when you think about it, I mean, what would we have if he did? Well, he would just probably have killed himself, and there would have been no book. But underneath all this, he's ultimately going to make it, Solomon is. It's my opinion, that he makes the turn, turns the corner and makes a comeback. And again, as long as you're alive, there's a chance for that. But you have to humble yourself. See, he had to humble himself. Paul had to humble himself. Nebuchadnezzar had to humble himself. On and on and on. So I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. Again, the whole idea here under the sun, conjuring up the image of hard work in the brutal heat. And the whole word labor there is amal, again, toil, hard work, the unpleasant aspects of it. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored. And again, the translation here is actually a singular, not with them. It's with it or with him. And again, the it would sort of sum them up, wisdom, knowledge, and skill, but it is a third person singular. So, Solomon may be bemoaning the fact that his family did not participate in any of these great projects, that he did them all by himself. So he could be bemoaning that. That's one possible way you could view this. Or he could be saying that the guy has not labored with the aforementioned wisdom, knowledge, and skill, that he did it. This too is vanity and a great evil. Okay, we had started into this on Thursday. Let's pick up at point 7 here. Koheleth has now made a conscious decision to seek no further satisfaction in his wealth, accumulation of details, or his ambitious project. And I left some things off of this list. I think he's given up on entertainment, too. I think he's probably given up on women making him happy. I think he's given up on a lot of these, all these things. That all these things he set forth there in chapter 2 that he did, he's recognized now, okay, no point in this any longer. And so that's even further depressing. Now where are you going to turn? And so there is this sense in which, strangely enough, because he is positive, God has kind of hemmed him in. He's got nowhere to go now. He's done it all. He's been to the peaks. He's been to the valleys. He's been to the mountaintop. And nothing satisfies. So is there any satisfaction in life? I assume that's probably his question by this point. Will I ever be satisfied? Is there anything for me in all of this? And in some ways, of course, this is just God driving Solomon back to himself, letting him run to his leash as far as he wanted to, you know. But he's like those dumb dogs, if you've ever seen them. We used to have them when I was a kid all the time. My dad always had dogs. And in order to train him, he'd put him on a choke collar. And you know what those are. And that once you get to the end of that leash, that collar tightens. And if you're running real fast, I've literally seen them all four legs come off the ground, snap backwards, and fall straight on their back. Well, that's where Solomon is. He's at the end of the choke collar. And he's not liking it. Well, would you like it? Not really. No, but if you ever get there, you're going to know this feeling. You're going to understand where he's coming from. So he's made a conscious decision here to just give up on all this. I turn myself around for the purpose of despairing. I'm giving in to depression now. Well, I wonder if this will make you happy. Probably not. So 8 here, the verb should be understood in an aggressive sense and translated, I began to despair. Since this expresses the fact that Koheleth went from not having a sense of despair to capitulating to a sense of it. And I suspect, when I say it began to, I suspect this has been building over time. You don't get to, you know, you don't go from just, you know, high, totally happy to complete despair in, you know, 1 minute. This takes some time. And I think he's begun to despair because he's finally figured out there's nowhere else to go. There's nothing else to do. And my life doesn't make me happy. Well, why doesn't your life make you happy? Whose fault is that? It's yours. You can stand around and point the finger at any people you want. And typically, people point to their authority. Well, it's my authority's fault I'm not happy. No. No. Or they may point it to the person underneath their authority. Oh, so it's that person's fault I'm not happy. It's my boss, my husband, my wife, my kids. Yeah, it's my friends. My friends are all idiots. Well, you're their friend. They may be idiots. That's a possibility. No, that's not it. Happiness comes from within. You can't point to someone else and say they're the problem. If there's a problem, it lies with you. It's within. It's not without. So the verb here, ya'ash, to despair, has the sense of being depressed or despairing so that one gives up a particular pursuit. We saw that there when 1 Samuel 27:1, where David said, Saul will despair of pursuing me. In other words, he'll give up. And then Isaiah 57:10 was sort of a positive thing out of that. You don't despair, so you don't give up. So 10, Koheleth has come to the point where he is so disillusioned with the recognition that he is leaving everything to someone else that he simply now loses interest, destroying any creative impulses he might have had. 11, the New American Standard Translation, as well as several others, have recognized that it was not his actual labor that depressed him. Again, we pointed out, he took some momentary satisfaction in that. He at least acknowledged that in chapter 2 there, that I was pleased from my labor, that there was a certain pleasure that came out of all of this. And that was the reward, was that momentary pleasure. But that's not long-term satisfaction, is it? Again, that's the whole point. Momentary pleasure is not long-term satisfaction. And people that seek momentary pleasure are going to find out it doesn't work in the long run. Here they point out that it's the actual results or the fruit of that labor that he was leaving behind, all his works. And 12, this leads him to the logical but distressing conclusion that there is simply no point in working anymore. I mean, why bother? If you're going to leave it all to everybody and there's every chance the person might be an idiot, well, why bother working anymore? Just retire and see if you enjoy that. Well, he's not going to enjoy that either. That's the beauty of these things. And look where Solomon lives. He's not corralling his STA, but he lives in this great, luxurious splendor. He's got all the money, all the servants, all the fame, got everything, and he's just sitting there miserable under his STA, under his sin nature, which has dominated him now to the point where he's just miserable. And why is he so unhappy? Well, it's his own fault, is it not? Nobody made him do these things. Nobody twisted his arm. Nobody pushed him into this. He made these conscious, bad choices for an extended period of time that led him to this horrific conclusion now. And I don't see anything in this chapter at all until we get close to the end of it. I don't see anything that's of any positive benefit in here at all. The only one good thing he has said so far was, well, the wise man can at least see where he's going. The fool can't even he's not illuminated with respect to what's going on around him. So, he does this himself. He does this to himself. Nobody does it to him. So he sits there with all of this glory, with all this splendor, fame, money, all the wealth, everything. Greatest food, greatest entertainment, and he's just miserable. He's just absolutely miserable. Just depressed to the point of suicide, I think. But he's not going to do that because, again, he doesn't lose all his doctrine just because he's done this. It's been degraded, certainly. His views and his logic are flawed at this point. That's another thing that, as he points out to you, he holds his younger self up for scrutiny, and he doesn't tell you, oh, yeah, I was screwed up. He's kind of expecting you to figure that out. And that none of this worked, and I'm a case history that it doesn't work. So he comes to some, his logic begins to break down too, as we saw there with the point about death. It's not, there were several logical fallacies to what he said. And again, if the reader doesn't see through them, well, then he's not going to see through them. Well, 13, the last phrase of verse 20 conjures up the idea of a man toiling pointlessly under the heat of a relentless burning sun. 14, one should recognize that Koheleth understood that this was not something unique to him, but is something that is common to the human experience. Point 15, this is documented by the general statement he makes in verse 21. which is designed to make his point in a universal sense. When there is a man, not just me. Now, he obviously is the man in view in this particular deal because he's the one that did it. But he's recognized that there are other people like him out there that have done these things, that have labored with skill and wisdom, with wisdom, knowledge, and success, better yet. The idea is that, guess what? They leave all their stuff to somebody too. They're no better off than I am. So 16 here, the conjunction key that has been translated when, for, or because. However, as Crenshaw observes, when coupled with the particle of existence, yesh, there exists, it introduces a condition. And the idea here is, if there is a man, as it would maybe be a better translation, or since there is a man. And then he points out, well, then this is all vanity and futility too. And the idea here is, again, we know that this truth exists. So 17, Koheleth is stating a general truth about the reality that even if anyone works hard and capably and has accumulated a few details, he is forced to leave them all to someone that has not contributed any effort. And let's face it, I don't know about you, but that galls me. I do not like the idea of working my fingers to the bone and someone taking advantage of me. I don't care for that at all. But if people take advantage of us, it's only because we let them, isn't it? And there's this little two-letter word, no. You can say it. The fact that the person hasn't contributed anything to this is equally damaging in his thinking. Is that, you go out and you work on a job and you say you're on a crew and you got five guys and three of you work real hard and two of them are slackers and the two get paid the same as you. Well, how does that make you feel? Do you like that? I wouldn't like it. I wouldn't care for that at all. I expect people to contribute effort to pull their own weight. That's the way life is. That was one of the first things my dad taught me. There isn't any free lunch out there. You want something, you're going to have to go get it. And if you go get it, it's going to cost money. And if you don't have money, you're going to have a job. Okay. And so you pay for everything right out of the chute, or at least I did. And it didn't hurt me one iota. Of course, if our country would do this today, kids would be a lot different. But that's probably not going to happen. The work ethic has been destroyed, as we know, at some level. I mean, it just astonishes me. Even when I go through like a fast food thing, they hand you their food, they can't even say thank you. I mean, it's just pathetic. That was one of the first things we learned at Whataburger. Please and thank you. May I take your order? What do you want? Yeah, that's what you get today, though, if you go out sometimes and deal with the public. What do you want? They act like they're doing you a favor by you writing their paycheck. They've not been taught that the customer writes the paycheck. He signs them. So people don't really contribute at some level. It's galling. Basic, human integrity and work ethic has been gone. Well, Solomon doesn't like that either. I did all this. This person didn't even chip in. It's the old, what was it, the little red hen story. You don't remember the little red hen story, don't you? Who's going to help me plant this wheat? Oh, not I. I'm busy. I got stuff to do. Who's going to help me water the wheat? Who's going to help me harvest the wheat? Who wants to eat the bread? Oh, I do. Little red hen. I can't remember the end of the story, but I hope the little red hen didn't give him any bread. I don't remember the end of it, but I hope the little red hen didn't give him any bread. They don't deserve any bread. And people want to, if they want to contribute, fine. If they don't want to contribute, they don't want to be a part of the deal, well, then, so what? That doesn't impress me one little bit. So 18, he describes a person that has worked in a wise fashion, employed the technical skill necessary to complete his work, and was ultimately successful in gaining a measure of prosperity. And again, I really like a better translation, I think, for that verse there, is the man that labors with wisdom, skill, and success, rather than knowledge and skill. Or skill, knowledge, and success, however you would like to do it. But the last word, success, is a much better translation. which comes about as the result of skill, of course. Skill brings success. There is that advantage to being skillful. You'll probably be successful. So, 19, while one might naturally admire that person and congratulate him on his success, Koheleth sees nothing to be happy about in the situation. 20, he must then leave all his accumulated success to another person that has not expended any effort, applied any wisdom, or worked with any skill at all. And my suspicion, although I can't prove it, and I think he's generalized this on purpose, but I got to believe his kid is on his mind. There are several verses in this book, and very much so. I think this is probably, maybe his son was the initial audience for this book. Certainly the younger generation was. Of that there is no doubt. That was one of the things that took me a while to figure out, but there are hints in here and clues that this was written to younger people. That here's a wise old guy giving you advice. Will you listen? And he does it in such a way, and again, I really admire this. None of this sounds preachy to me, does it, to you? Like, hey, I'm old, I'm wise, you better listen. It's, hey, I was young, I did this and this and this and this, and look out and look what it got me. Don't make the same, you know, without saying it, what he's saying is don't make the same mistakes I make. And that is one of the things about a wise older person. They really don't want to see people repeat the mistakes they've made. They know where many of the landmines are. They know where many of the pitfalls are out there. And I was young and arrogant and cocky once. Well, God will knock a lot of that out of you over time. He darn sure will. And it's for your own good. It's for your own benefit. If you won't humble yourself, God will humble you. And if you want to run around and be arrogant, try it. But I'm just warning you, it's going to be painful. And Solomon's found out the hard way. Nebuchadnezzar found out the hard way. Paul found out the hard way. The list goes on and on and on. So, again, this person he's going to leave it to, I got to believe that his son is at the back of his mind on this. And again, maybe he is the target audience for this book initially. That his son might have been the first to read all this. I don't know. Solomon might have written this and then given it to his son. Say, check this out. Who knows? But certainly we do know there's, again, enough clues in here to warn you, to tell you that this was written targeted to a younger audience. And when you're an old wise guy targeting a younger audience, you got to kind of be careful how you approach it. And I think that explains the form of this book as well. People have bemoaned all this. This isn't Solomon's normal style and all that. It's not these short, pithy proverbs. Well, there are some of those in the book. He's going to give you some short, pithy proverbs. But the idea here is that he likes this idea of a treatise, in a way, at this point, to communicate his point. And really, he only has one point in this, right? At the end of it all, when all's been said and done. Fear God and keep his commandments. Isn't that his only real point in this whole book? So why is he going this way to get there? To show you that this way doesn't work. This way doesn't lead there. And if this is what you want, if you ultimately want to do it right in the Christian life, if you ultimately want to live before God and be a successful person, be a happy person, and all this, this isn't the way to go about it. So here again, I think his son is at least in the back of his mind, if not maybe even in the forefront sometimes. So again, he has to leave all of this to another person who has not expended any effort, applied any wisdom, or worked with any skill at all. Do you like the thought of that? Okay, I've got this lazy, spoiled child who doesn't do anything, and he's going to inherit everything I've got. Oh no, that wouldn't be satisfying at all, I wouldn't think. Well, 21, while many of the translations, like the New American Standard, have translated the preposition bath here, be, with the third masculine singular suffix as with them, the most natural sense is the singular suffix would refer to the man who labored. And again, while I can allow for the other interpretation, it would seem to me with him is a much better translation here. That's the more natural sense of the Hebrew. 22, although Longman suggests that this verse does not allude to the normal process of inheritance, since the one who benefits is designated by an individual rather than by a son, the natural sense of the verb nathan, to give, would suggest that this is voluntary. I completely disagree with his conclusion here that this isn't referring to the normal process of inheritance, because he didn't, because he says he gives his legacy. Well, who are you going to give it to? And the idea here is clearly inheritance, and he's talking about his immediate heirs, what he's talking about. And I don't see how you could read these verses and this whole context here and not understand that. But that's again the value of commentary. Sometimes they'll make a really good statement, occasionally, and sometimes they'll make a really stupid statement. That's why it's not really beneficial for sheep to read them, because you're not equipped, I don't think, to wade through all that and figure it out. See, some sheep think they are, they have been, and they're not in Bible class anymore because they think they're smarter than the pastor. And that doesn't work, unfortunately. Like at least I have to give the Ethiopian eunuch there high kudos. He was smart enough to recognize and state, how can I understand this unless somebody shows me? So unless somebody explains it to me. So a sheep goes out there and starts devouring commentaries and all this and that. Well, he swallows a bunch of junk. A bunch of junk. And then it's almost impossible to get them to regurgitate it because they think they've got it figured out. Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. This isn't the process God has established, unfortunately. And while we want you to think for yourself, we obviously also should recognize that the process God has established is a local church, a pastor, teacher, and you follow one drummer, one pastor per congregation. That's easily documentable in the New Testament. Easily documentable. Not the least of which is the seven churches in Revelation to the pastor of the church of so-and-so, right? And all that. So this is the way it has to be. You have to get in line, follow one drummer, and you have to make it. And one person can get you to maturity. One person can do right by you if the person's serious and wants to do the job right, which I am and I do. But you read these commentaries, guess what? They're just absolutely worthless at a certain... I may have 7 or 8 commentaries, and I even have read more on this book, and I'll bet you see how often I cite them, don't you? Because when I do cite them, I give them credit for it, whether they're right or whether they're wrong. But you may only get, on a couple of given verses, you may get one sound thought, maybe, out there, which is kind of a sad commentary, but that's the way it is. And the irony is that sometimes the more conservative commentaries, ones that you would think, well, okay, they're conservative, I can trust them, they'll be the furthest afield. And sometimes the liberal technical commentaries will have a comment in there that's absolutely right on point and really explains something. But, again, a good commentary, by the way, has to be technical in nature. So unless you can read Hebrew and Greek and sometimes Latin and German, they're not that helpful sometimes. Because you have to stop and go look up all the words, see what he's saying. So again, I don't know how he missed this point, but to me the verses just scream, you know, he's talking about his inheritance. He's talking about his heir here. 23, what is strangely absent from Kohelet's viewpoint is the natural sense of pleasure that one derives from bestowing blessings upon his heirs. Now what's the normal human thought here? Okay, I've worked hard. Most parents, their normal thought is they want their children to have more than they have. Now, that's their normal human viewpoint thought, but recognize that that is strictly human viewpoint. Whether your kid has more or less is really not relevant, is it? And it's not up to you to determine it. But most parents, they live their lives, they accumulate their estate, whatever, and they write all the children into the will, or however they want to divide it up. And then they divide it up, and they have a certain satisfaction in that. Okay, well, at least when I die, the government's not going to get my stuff. My kids are. Most normal people take a little bit of pleasure out of that. Not Solomon. Not at this point in his life. All he can see is that, again... And here, as Crenshaw puts it very well here, as Crenshaw has keenly observed, the sage's egocentric perspective stands out here, since his attitude is self-centered. But as I pointed out in this chapter, I, me, and mine dominate, and myself. All through it, I. And, literally, when you start looking at it, the eyes start jumping out at you. There's so many of them. The eyes have it. they do in this chapter, that's for sure. The selfish attitude, point 25, is expressed by the idea, I earned the wages, I did the work, I made the sacrifice, and everything I have accumulated should remain mine. That's the idea of it. But, and what he's so upset about is the fact that he can't, and there's another area of frustration. Can he do anything about this? No, not at all. He's going to die, and he's going to leave everything behind, and he can't change that. And you know how it is, you know, if you get under your STA and you're frustrated, doesn't each new little thing just frustrate you to the maximum again? Drive you to further and further frustration? Well, it does with him here. And everything he thinks about just serves as another nail in his coffin as he sees it. As I see it, this should all be mine. It's not going to be mine. As I see it, the heir might be a fool. Probably will be. As I see it, he didn't do any work. Why should he have any of this? And now, are those all not legitimate viewpoints, valid viewpoints? Yeah, people, those are all at least normal, valid viewpoints. Are they the right viewpoint, however? Is this the right attitude behind all this? And the answer is no, but how did he work himself into this dither again? How did he get to this point? And so the deal is the STA has paid him back with what it's always said we'd pay him back with, death. Solomon is here temporarily, I would believe, completely out of fellowship as he writes about this. I don't think he's making any allusions that I'm a spiritual believer and you should live your life this way. I think his whole point here is that all this STA pleasing of yourself doesn't bring pleasure, doesn't bring happiness, doesn't bring contentment. And so you can pursue the sin nature all you want. But the wages of the STA is death, Romans 6:23. And the free gift of God is eternal life. Now, the fundies have always used that verse as a salvation verse. It's not a salvation verse. It's in the middle of this treatise on the STA that Paul does. So here again, he's completely self-centered. It's mine, 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 mine. Saw Finding Nemo last night, the little seagulls. Mine, 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 mine. The value of having a grandkid, you get to see those kinds of movies. So things you probably wouldn't have watched as an adult otherwise. Well, Koheleth here, point 26, takes no pleasure in the thought that he will be leaving everything to someone else. Further, there can be little doubt that he was thinking in terms of his own life and the fruit of his labor, which he will not be able to keep. In 27, he classifies this as another example of vanity. And again, pointless, temporary, waste of time, absurd, however you want to translate the term, empty, vapid, all these things. Going on to call it a great evil. Or a serious injustice. Well, who's the author of this serious injustice, may we ask? Where did this serious injustice come from? Is not this God's world? Did he not establish the order of it? But when you're out of fellowship, do you want to think about that? When you're mad and frustrated and depressed, do you want to think, oh, well, this is God's world? And, you know, let's place the blame where it really belongs here. Anytime you want to blame somebody, you better blame God. Because God has allowed this in your life. He's done either one of two things. He's either allowed it under his permissive will, or he's directly engineered it in your life. And if he's done it, you can argue about people. You can complain about people. You can say, well, they did this, they did that. Sure. But if he's done it, then who do you really need to take it up with? You really need to take it up with God. And stop looking at the people. Take it up with God. God's engineered this, allowed it, done it, or whatever. But it's God's world. And ultimately, as we will see, he's going to bemoan that fact a little bit in chapter 3. And God controls the timing of events, not us. God controls the when you were born, did you vote on that? Did you get any say-so in that? Did you get to pick your name? Did you get to say anything? No, you came into the world with nothing. And when God determined to impart the neshama, that spark of life, when you came out of the womb there, did you determine the timing of that? Do you determine the timing of your death? And if you can't determine these really big, important things, well, what difference does it make about the other things, really? Do you determine the time for conflict and the time for peace? At a certain level? No, sometimes these things are brought on us. We have no choice. And if that's the way it is, it's the way it is. But God controls all that. And so, again, if you're going to blame somebody, get real and start blaming God. And admit that you're really unhappy with Him. That's the problem. It's not people, it's God that you're unhappy with. So he calls this, again, a serious injustice, a grievous evil, a burden on him that he just is, oh man. But again, who's the author of this injustice? Solomon doesn't get to that point in his thinking yet. So verse 28 here, or point 28, this verse is not simply a repetition of verse 19, where he was concerned that his heir might be a fool. What tortures Koheleth here is that all his hard work will be given to one that did nothing to earn it. And that, at a certain level, that is, that is something that's not a satisfying thought. I would take no pleasure in working my life away, scrimping, saving, accumulating this inheritance, and then, like the prodigal son, he goes out and squanders it in 2 weeks, or however long he took him. Didn't take him long, I don't think. And if a person can't handle $50, what in the world makes you think they can handle $50,000? And that is a galling thought to me, too. Now, I'm not going to sit around and agonize over it like Koheleth did. I mean, I'm not going to get out of fellowship over it. But that is an issue. That is a point. I don't like the thought of, people mismanaging what I work so hard to get. And that's his thought, too. He doesn't like that. Now, this is really distressing for him, whereas you look at you and I might look at it and think, well, yeah, I wouldn't want that either, and then you move on. He's wallowing in it. He's just thrilled. I mean, he's pleasuring in his misery, we might say, reveling in it, that this is all so God-awful. Well, point verse 22 now, vanity in the day and vanity in the night. It never stops. It never ends. For what does a man get in all his labor and his striving with which he labors under the sun? Again, here, what you've probably figured out, when he asks these rhetorical questions, they aren't designed to solicit, oh, he gets a great deal of pleasure and happiness. You know that when he asks these rhetorical questions, he's setting you up for, he gets nothing. He gets nothing, and I'm going to prove he gets nothing. He gets less than nothing. What does a man? Because, again, here, conjunction he, key rather, in a causal sense. Because, or for. What is the interrogative particle ma? What does a man get is actually what becomes, or literally what is becoming. It's a participle here. What's actually happening in all of this when you're out there doing all this hard work and labor? What's really coming out of it? What is becoming to a man? Prefix lamed plus the general generic term for man, adam. A-D-H-A-M. What is becoming? What is happening? What is being gained? They've translated it as a finite verb. What does he get? But gaining, or what is he getting, would be even be better. What is he getting? Hernias? Ulcers? Broken hearts? What's he getting in all this? What is a man gaining or getting in all his labor? Prefix bait here plus the masculine singular noun construct of coal in all of his labor is, again, amal, our word, the toil word, the burdensome, wearisome word for work, labor. And in his striving is a wow here plus a prefix bait in his, and then you got this word, ragyon. R-A-apostrophe-Y-O-N. Three times it's used only in the Ecclesiastes. Longing or striving. The Talmud, which again a Jewish commentary, uses the word in the sense of ambition. And this is another whole issue here when you get into a critical analysis of this book. Solomon uses words, now he's writing circa 940 BC, something like that. And he'll use words in a way that they don't see used this way again until much, much later in history. Sometimes even into, after the birth of Christ, they'll find these words used. And so then that's why they want to make this book and date it much later than it really is. But we have to recognize that Solomon had an extensive vocabulary. that he was incredibly wise, that he had great contact with these neighboring nations and all of that, and would have been very familiar with their vocabulary and all of that. And so the critics of this book want to say, well, see, this one man could not have written this. These are all borrowed from, this is borrowed from the Aramaic, which occurred much later. Well, perhaps Solomon coined the term. Who's to say? As we saw there, it appeared that Paul coined that term, arsenokoites, based on the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew. There's no evidence that he didn't. Well, maybe Solomon was way ahead of the game. That's my answer to the critics, is that I'm going to suggest that Solomon was way ahead of the game, had a much more extensive vocabulary, a much broader sort of cosmopolitan view of the world than these people did. And he's not locked into this rigidness that they, you know, well, he has to use this vocabulary. Well, no, he doesn't. He can use any he wants. So again, here he uses this word, there are a number of hapaxes, and that's used only once, or a term that's used. There's some hapaxes, but there's also many terms in this book I've already seen that are used only in Ecclesiastes, that's unique to Solomon. And again, given his knowledge, skill, and all that words, I wouldn't be surprised by that. So, what does a man get in all his labor and his striving? And again, if you use the term ambitious work here, that he's, you know, he's ambitiously working, with which he labors under the sun. What does he get in which he labors is actually a prefix lamed here, plus the masculine singular noun construct of lave, for his heart, literally, is what you have here. What does it do for his heart? And the heart being, of course, the real you, the current you. What's the current guy getting out of all of this, all out of what you're doing? Which, again, the prefixed relative pronoun in the shortened form, sheen. He is the pronoun masculine singular of who, with which he works. Toils is amel, just a variant form, a noun, masculine singular noun. Toil or labor, again, I can't see a whole lot of distinction between amel and amal, frankly. I didn't. None of the lexicons make any big distinction between them. So it may just be a variant pointed form, and it may be the very same word. Because as you probably know, and if you don't, then you'll learn something today, the original Hebrew in the Masoretic text does not have vowel points. It just has the radicals. And so the Masoretes, the scribes, pointed this. The labor which he labors under the sun, takath, again, the preposition with the definite article, and shemesh. Verse 23, because all his days are painful, and his task is vexing. Because is, again, conjunction key here used in an explanatory sense. Because all masculine singular noun construct, all his days of coal. All, and then the masculine singular noun construct with a third masculine suffix of yom. All his days, every day, day in and day out, we might say. Day in and day out is pain. That's it. That's what he says you get out of it. It's painful. Masculine plural noun here, and note that it is a plural. Various shades of pain. It's not just painful. They translated it. You know, kind of like it's an adverb, but his days are pains. 16 times this verb, makhov, M-A-K-H, apostrophe O-B-H. Makhov, 16 times the verb, can denote physical pain and or mental emotional pain, grief or sorrow. It's used, for instance, in Exodus 3:7. And my suspicion here is with this word that both are in view. That in life you get, you know, your aches and pains, we might say. And then you have your emotional pain, your griefs and your sorrows that go with that. 16 times here, Exodus 3:7. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people in Egypt. And have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. And I don't have my text, but I think the word sufferings is what we're looking at there. That's the makhov word, is the latter word there in the text. So again, the sufferings, how were they suffering? Well, obviously physically they were suffering. They were being used as slave labor. But this has a mental and emotional component to wear on you as well. And particularly when they were, you know, they had the forced genocide in place, killing the male children. You know, that obviously would be more of an emotional crippling pain than a physical pain. All his days, pains, are filled with pains, we might say. And his task is vexing. And you've got the masculine singular noun here of kaas, K-A-apostrophe-A-S. The verb means to vex, provoke, agitate, or irritate. So vexation, provocation, irritation would be a good idea. His tax is vexation. And again, the word task is a masculine singular noun construct of inyan. This word, again, is a neutral term, but just denotes that which one does, that which occupies it. Apostrophe I-N-Y-A-N. His task, his work, whatever, you know, you fill your days with. What do you fill your days with? Well, Solomon says this is all just pains and a masculine singular noun and vexation. Mental, emotional pains and vexation. That's what you get from it. Even at night, his mind does not rest. A conjunction here, gam, is also indeed, or even here, probably used in an offensive sense, talking about, he's citing here the most notable example. That at night, when you're supposed to be sleeping and resting and recharging your batteries and all of that, of course, none of us have ever laid awake and rolled things over in our heads and relived them and replayed them and all that. Of course you do. We've all done it. Even at night, even in the night, literally, prefix bait plus the word layla, L-A-Y-L-A-H. During the night, literally, prefix bait plus it's an arthrous here, not the night, but at night, maybe, or during the night, his mind does not rest. The word shakat here with a negative low, and then the verb is S-H-A-K-H-A-B-H. This word means to lie down, to recline, hence to rest. Even at night, his mind does not lay down. And sometimes you can't get the mind to stop, can you? And of course, in the broad spectrum of Hebrew thought, he uses the word for heart. Masculine singular noun construct of lave plus the third masculine singular suffix. His heart does not rest. Now we might say, this could have given rise to the phrase, there's no rest for the weary. Because his days are wearisome, and his night is equally wearisome when he should be resting. And we've all probably known that frustration of being dead tired, and you couldn't turn your mind off. And your mind just kept racing and going, and you couldn't do anything about it. You just laid there awake. You look at the clock, it's 1:30, now it's 4. Yeah, we all know what that's like, don't we? Especially when you're under some big, huge pressure, some test and all that, and it's just, you can't put it away. You can't get away from it at some level, even at night when you should be resting. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This also, masculine, again, the conjunction gam here, also this masculine singular adjective, this is vanity. And then you have the hevel, our word for vanity that we've seen throughout this book many times already. The only word I think we've seen more than vanity is I, or myself. I, myself, and vanity. Those are the primary words so far in this book. And then you got the pronoun, third masculine singular, who, which in this case acts as a copula, sort of acts as the to-be verb. This, vanity is. This is vanity also. Okay, well, we've only got a couple of minutes, so I'm not going to dive into this. You'll get an extra few minutes today, and we'll pick up here at 5 after.